Okay, we're going to talk about debt a little bit, and primarily we're going to talk about types of debt that you'd be possibly looking for in your companies. Types of debt that we have are basically secured, non-secured. Secured is almost entirely where you would be in your company. Because banks aren't going to loan you unless they have something secured against. An unsecured note is where it's just called a promissory note, where you go to the bank and say, gee, I'd like to borrow this much money. And they lend it to you for, you know, basically whatever you want to do with it. In that situation, you have to have good credit ratings. You have to have good income over your expenses. You have to have assets you can pledge against it, things of that sort. So with secured debt for companies, obviously a mortgage is a very common type of secured debt. If you need to buy a building, buy a piece of land, things like that, you can take a loan against that because that asset itself is security for the loan. Collateral trust bonds, equipment trust certificates, other types of things are different types of security that can be offered against to secure a loan. So let's say we're starting a business that's a store. And for that store, we need, maybe we're going to rent the property, so we don't need to worry about financing that. We've got all the stuff we're going to put in it. So we've got the fixtures. We've got equipment that goes in the store. And so to buy that, we could arrange possibly with a bank to take a loan to buy that equipment and secure it with the equipment. The bank wouldn't lend us everything we need. We'd have to come up with some from other places because they would want, you know, between usually about 80% of the value of what they're pledging against is going to be what they'll loan. And in the case of that type of fixture, it may be less because there's not much marketability for that. The bank would say, gee, if we had to repossess this stuff, what are we going to do with it? You know, how easy is it to sell? And so they would take that into consideration too. But if you have things to borrow against, then getting a loan is a possibility. Taking loans against inventory, taking loans against accounts receivable, that's pledging some asset for as security against a loan and being able to turn that into cash. So secured debt is one area, and the other is unsecured debt, which is basically not secured by any particular asset, but a general obligation of the company. Bonds, typically, what we think of as debentures, normal bonds in corporate financing, are unsecured debt. They're not secured by any particular asset. They're, if the company goes into bankruptcy, the things that are secured by particular assets would be sold first and taken care of, and then all the other assets would be sold, and that value would be placed against the unsecured obligations. And then we can also have some types of tax exempt. Yeah. Things with debt different than common stock. We have a stated maturity, almost always where the debt matures at a point in time and must be paid back. Stated principal amount, what will be paid back. Stated coupon rate of interest, the dollar amount of interest that gets paid every period. There may be, typically is, a mandatory redemption or sinking fund schedule, which simply means that if a company issues long-term debt, say 20-year debt, that the lenders would require that it pay down that debt over time so that at the end of 20 years, the whole thing wouldn't be due. Typically, it would be in five-year intervals so that the lenders might say, well, within the first 5 years, you need to have paid down 20% of this. It can be either that, you know, you just pay off the debt or you borrow it from another source and pay off that way. And after another 5 years, it's another 20% and so on. So at the end of 20 years, there may only be 20% left to pay off. So that reduces the risk for the lenders and gives sort of a more more discipline to the company of paying down that debt over time. There may be an optional redemption provision, call provision, which says that the company may buy back that share, debt from the lenders at any point in time at an agreed upon value that's written in the contract. So If, in other words, if the company doesn't borrows 20 years and doesn't want to let it go for 20 years, it has the right to pay that off sometime before that. And protective covenants we talked about as being the restrictions that are put into the agreement by the lenders that prescribe what the company can and cannot do that would increase the risk of the loan, and the company has to comply with that. Those optional redemption provisions, one is a call provision. Callable bonds are a common sort of debt that's issued that simply says that the company, once it issues the debt, has the right to call part or all of that issue within restrictions. Typically, if it's a 20-year issue, they're precluded from calling within the first 5 years, so the lenders have that protection during that time. Because and lenders need that because a lot of the loans are done by institutional investors, pension funds, insurance companies, others that are using the debt to block against obligations that they know are going to come due at particular points in time. So they can, an insurance company, a pension fund can estimate pretty accurately over a long period of time what its cash flows are going to need to be on average, and then books its securities, books its loans and other things with maturities that match those times when that money is due. So they don't want to be in a situation where they think it's going to be matching an obligation that's this long and it ends up being this long. So you usually have some protection from that. There's a premium, so the company can't, the company hasn't agreed upon price at any point in time. So when the bond is issued and the lender gives the money, the lender knows right up front that, okay, it can be called during this year for this much money and during this year for this much money and so on. So they know the schedule right up front. They're getting a premium when it is called, and that amount declines over time until we get to the end of the life of the loan. Convertible bonds are a little different, and they're an interesting way to finance companies, particularly young companies, companies that are growing. What a convertible bond does is give the lender the option to convert that debt into equity, into stock, at any point in time, at the option of the lender. And there's an agreed upon conversion, so the bond will say right up front that this bond is convertible at any time into X number of shares. And so the bondholder now has an advantage. We can keep it debt. If the company doesn't end up growing well and the stock price doesn't grow, then we can just hold it as debt. We have a primary obligation. The company still has to pay interest and principal. But if the company does well and the stock price goes up, the bondholder can elect to turn it into common stock and now have much more upside potential for gain than they would have had as a bond. One thing about a bond that's different from common stock is, you know, a bond, you can all see this if I write it here. If you look at the probability distribution on a bond as far as a rate of return goes, where this is probability and this is the rate of return that we're gonna get. A bond's probability distribution looks like that. It's all downside risk. You can't make more than the guarantee. If you hold it until maturity and the bond says it's going to be a 10% interest bond, you're going to make 10% if you hold it until maturity. You're not going to make more. You can make less. The bond could default. You could lose everything. So your downside risk is 100%. Your upside risk is nothing. So the best you can do is what was guaranteed on the bond, unless you sell it early, and then you've got valuation things that come in there. Common stock, on the other hand, has a distribution that cuts both ways. You have an expected rate of return when you buy the instrument, but you could make a lot more than that, or you could make a lot less than that. So you've got both sides of the risk, the good side and the bad, whereas the bondholders only have the bad side. By having a convertible bond, you're giving the bondholders the opportunity to have that upside gain as well. And so at their option, if the company is doing well, they can convert it into common stock. The great thing about that for the company is a couple things. If it turns out that the company does well and the bonds convert, That means we never have to pay them back. They self-liquidated. We didn't have to pay off those bonds. They just went away. What actually happened is we diluted the ownership interest a little bit when they converted to common stock, but we never had to pay them off. No cash had to go out. And it also essentially allows equity to be sold out without any of the transaction costs and other things that go along with it. So it's usually not a quick thing. It trickles out over time. And so the dilution impact is not terrible because it doesn't happen all at once. But if it turns out that the company does well, then that debt just evaporates and we don't have to pay it back. With risk considerations, there are bond ratings, of course, and there's a link there where you can look at the bond ratings, but basically there are a couple companies that make it their business, have for a long time, to benchmark the risk of corporate bonds and other types of debt against others. And so there's a rating list, and essentially you have a top two-tier, triple A's and double A's, that are very secure investments. A little below that, the A's and the double B's are still in good quality, but a little lower than the top tier. And then you get down into more risky bonds and all the way down into junk bonds and defaults and others. So those ratings are applied to bonds and are fairly consistent across the rating agencies. Basically, as you go down that list of ratings, you're going up in cost for the company because you're going up in risk for the investors. So your bond rating is directly linked to your cost of debt. And the lower your rating, the higher your cost of debt will be. So keeping ratings at good levels and not deteriorating them is very important because it drives up your cost of borrowing and your cost of capital.
I have a question about that. When someone's rating is downgraded, that doesn't affect the current debt they're paying off. It just affects new debt for the cost of capital?
No, it affects the current debt. It doesn't...
But the percentage they're paying out changes immediately for...
No, well, that's what it doesn't affect, but what it... Once we issue a bond, if the coupon rate on the bond is 10%, mm-hmm. we're going to pay 10% as long as we hold that bond. Now, the people who bought the bond are going to get the 10% dollar payments that we're paying, but if the bond rating goes down, their value went down. So the value of what they're holding went down, even though their cash flows stay the same. So if they hold their bond until maturity, they're fine, as long as we don't default. But if they want to sell in the open market, which a lot of bondholders do, they use them for speculative purposes, just like they use common stock. So you got two things going on with your bond. You've got the value on a day-to-day basis that you can sell it for in the market, and you've got this constant interest payment. Well, the constant interest payment is going to stay the same as long as we don't default. But if we downgrade the bond, our value goes down. So now we've lost if we want to sell that bond. We can sell it. We can't sell it for as much. So we can take a loss on the value of the bond even though our cash flows stay the same. So from the company's point of view, it means that if they sell more debt, that they're going to have to pay a higher interest rate. So on their current debt, it isn't affecting it. It did affect the current bondholders. As debt is considered more risky, the common stock is considered more risky, so that trade-off between cost of equity and cost of debt, as we have more debt, common stock gets more expensive. As we have riskier debt, common stock gets more expensive. So there's both of those contribute to it. And then the cost of capital, if our cost of debt gets higher, as our ratings go down, then the cost of capital gets higher too, and we know the impact on value from that. Let's talk about short-term financing briefly. We've got talked about trade credit. Trade credit is the spontaneous short-term credit that comes from our suppliers giving us time to pay for inventory or other things we would be buying. We can also have secured, non-secured bank loans, which can be short-term. They can be lines of credit. They can be less than a year, 5 years, whatever. So they're different time levels of that. We'll talk about bank loans a little more in a minute. And then commercial paper is normally for larger companies that have a need, have an excess amount of cash that they might like to lend, or another company needs to borrow for short periods of time, 3 months or 6 months or so, and can issue a specialized contract out into the market that's a negotiable instrument that is essentially debt of various face values and various interest terms. I'm going to skip over the cost of trade credit here. Let's talk about bank loans. With short-term unsecured bank loans, basically looking at a lot of them behave a lot like your credit card would, except your credit card isn't necessarily short-term. So banks, when they're distinguishing between short-term loans and term loans, term loans are generally 1 to 5 years in maturity. Because of reporting regulations and reserve regulations for banks, they have to be careful about how they classify the loans. And so if they give you a one-year line of credit, typically what that means is you're going to have to pay that down to zero at some time during that year. And you may be able to renew it the following year, maybe at a different interest rate, but it's got to hit zero sometime during that year. So it's actually less than a year in maturity. But they can be loans for particular transactions. We need to buy something or buy some things, so we negotiate with a bank for a loan for that purpose. They can be a line of credit, which is like a credit card that says you've got a credit limit, you can borrow some of it, all of it, whatever, do what you need to with it for business purposes and pay interest on what you borrowed. And a revolving agreement would be one that has to be paid down and then can be renewed, so it can revolve over several years. Term loans are longer loans, 1 to 5 years typically, sometimes as much as 10, and banks do give those sorts of loans, usually a lot of restrictions on them. We'll talk about some of those in a minute. Some typical things on term loans are that banks are reluctant to give unsecured loans that are of a longer term because they're risky, and so they'll have provisions in them, lots of things that the company is supposed to stay in compliance with, that if it isn't, they can exercise a bullet maturity, which means that the bank can call the loan. If you're out of compliance, you know, if you had a 10-year loan or a 5-year loan, but you're out of compliance in some of the restrictions, the bank can say, well, you owe us the money now. And so it would be important to stay within those restrictions. And a balloon payment is simply a loan that doesn't pay off all of it over time, but may have a big amount due at the end of the time. So if you took a 5-year balloon loan for $5 million, you may pay off $1 million or $2 million over the 5 years and have a big amount still at the end. That amount could then be refinanced or paid off in another way. Okay, let's talk about what banks are looking for. There's a lot of an old saying that banks only lend to people that don't need it. And to some extent, that's true. But what they're really looking for, and if you as a small company went to a bank and said, we need to borrow money for a particular purpose, and here we're really looking at the unsecured types of loans, not things that have something to borrow directly against, the first and primary thing that they're going to look for is the character of the borrower. They need to know that person. And it goes beyond just thinking that that person is honest and trustworthy. It involves how much commitment is that person going to have if things get bad to make sure that this loan gets taken care of. How far are they going to go? Are they going to pick up and walk away? Or are they going to do everything they can to make sure that this is paid? And banks know that if a company gets in trouble, that it may not be that we can stay exactly within what the loan required us to do, but that if things get bad, we'll go to the bank and say, you know, we got a little problem here, and we're going to work through this, and we're going to do everything we can to make sure that you get our money, but, you know, can you work with us a little bit on the payments and you know, help us out a little bit, and we're going to get this back in tune. I mean, they're usually okay with that situation. They just don't want it to be, well, you know, we're gone and you don't have the money. So they want to know you're going to stick it out for the long haul. They want to make sure that you've got experience and expertise and that you're going to know what you're doing. So if things get tough, you're going to be carried off. So it's really a people situation that they're looking at. How's the lender going to assess your honesty? Well, there's several things. You have good business references. Well, if you're a startup, you may not. If not, then do you have a good personal references? Do you have a credit history, personal credit history, business credit history? Do you have ties to the business? This is where your equity stake comes in. How much money do you have in it? Because if you've got a lot of money into it personally, you're going to be very unlikely to let that business die without an awful lot of fight. And so the lenders look at that. That equity interest is their cushion for safety. And so the bigger that is, the better they'll feel. Do you have ties in the area? Are you many banks, less so now, it's getting less, but there's still a lot of local lending going on. So that local banks tend to lend in their local areas. And so they want to know, do you have ties in the area that you're doing business in? Are you likely to stay there? Are you a fly-by-night operation that's going to go off somewhere else? And so the more ties you have that area, and if you're investing, if you're building a business in a community where you live and you live there for a long time, you're unlikely to just walk away if the business does poorly. And so they'll look at that very carefully. Will you personally guarantee the loan? This really almost goes up to the top. For small businesses and startup businesses, we talked about limited liability, talked about corporations having limited liability, talked about that you can waive that limited liability, and in most cases when you take an unsecured bank loan, you'll have to waive it. Either you or someone else or a group of people are going to have to sign for that loan personally. So if you need, your assets of the group that is starting the business is not sufficient to take the loan, but you have other people that have substantial net worth and are willing to co-sign for that loan, which says to the bank that if the original borrowers can't pay it, these other people will, sort of guaranteeing the loan, then that will help too. So making personal guarantees against the loan becomes almost mandatory in a lot of situations. What's the purpose of the loan? What are you going to use it for? Now this is unsecured loan, so it's out of that transactional loan business, but they want to know, basically, what are you going to do? What do you need the money for? This is where a cash budget and things of that sort would come in very useful to show the bank, during this period, this six-month period, we have negative cash flows, but it's going to be positive after that, and so we need it to bridge here. Here's how we're going to do it. Here's the risk around that, how bad, how good we think it can be. So they get a clear picture of what you're going to do with it and how it's going to be used. And they want to see a link between how you're going to use it and the source of repayment. And so they want it to be in activities that are relatively safe. You obviously can't go and say, well, gee, we want to take a loan because we need some capital, so we're going to go off to Tunica, and maybe we'll come back with double. So they want to know what you're going to do with it within reason, not exactly what you're going to do with it. Another thing they're going to look for is this idea of separating out the common factors of production from the overall concept of the business. Okay? So when you talk about your businesses, you do an executive summary or something, you can talk about your business in kind of abstract terms about what you're going to do for people or society or this or that. What the business really is we've got this set of assets, we're going to make this thing, we're going to provide this service, we're going to do it this way, we're going to charge this much for it. And there are elements of that process that we need to fund to make it work. That's a whole lot different than this overall idea. So the common factors of production are what's necessary to make this thing work on a nuts and bolts level. And that's what they're going to look at funding. They want to know what this is going to be used for, how it fits into the production process or the providing of a service process, and they'll fund those. They don't want to say, hear, well, you know, we're going to start this wonderful business that's going to do great things, and we need $3 million. Well, so what do you want it for? So you've got to get down to the point where you can describe the process so that they know what they're funding. They also want to know, in that process, and those common factors of production, there are usually things that can be turned into cash if stuff gets tough. And so as part of the process, it may be that we're funding inventory, that we're funding accounts receivable, that we're funding into that working capital growing problem that we have if we grow. And if that's the case, then there are probably things we can identify that would be assets that could be used to provide payment if that was required. Next thing I want to know is, what's the primary source of repayment? Where is the money coming from to get this paid? Again, that's where a cash budget comes in very handy, because you can say, here's what our revenue stream is supposed to be, here's what our expenses are supposed to be, here's the gap that we're trying to fund for a while, and if it's a short-term loan, then here's where we're out of the gap, and this is where we're going to have excess cash that's going to be able to pay off your loan. And they're going to want to know, well, how bad can things get before you can't do that? And so you're going to have to show them that part too. You need the risk analysis there. So there needs to be a dependable stream there at some point for the repayment. Not necessarily every period. If you're a startup company or a growing company, you may not be able to make those payments right away. It may be that we need a line of credit where we don't have to pay this back until many months from now, or start paying it back, because that's why we need the money now. So it doesn't have to be like an installment loan where you're paying payments all over time. It can be geared to the cash flows you have, as long as you can identify where those are. Has to be supported by the cash cycle of the business. We've talked about the whole production cycle. And so depending on what your company is doing, if you're showing that you can make repayment out of what the company is doing, you have to show where in the production cycle that fits. Then they want to know, what's the secondary source of repayment? If you can't do the first one, what do you do then? So if the primary one that's supposed to be so dependable turns out to not be dependable, then what? And then you have to identify other sources, assets that can be sold, personal assets that can be pledged, co-signers, collateral, things of that sort that will provide that secondary source of repayment. That fails too. Then we're in a bankruptcy or Chapter 11 situation. Things get tough at that point. The loan is typically totally unsecured. That means there's no collateral. That doesn't mean that in the negotiation process you can't identify things that could be sold to make payment. They may not be directly linked to the loan, but they can still be identified as, gee, if things get real tough, we'd have these things to draw on as our secondary source of repayment. In the case of a bankruptcy, then what happens is unsecured lenders share equally in the value of the company's assets when they're sold, after all the other obligations, the secured obligations, have been paid, and taxes have been paid. And then from that, they may get much less than they were supposed to get, in many cases, 20, 30 cents on the dollar after waiting years and years to get it. So it's the unsecured lenders, the last thing they want to have happen is to go into bankruptcy. You'll also occasionally hear the banking jargon of the four C's, which is similar to what we just talked about, just a little different way to say it. So the first one is character, again, like the first one that we had. Capacity is the capacity to repay the loan and service the debt. So do we have are we generating the funds reliably that are going to be necessary to do that? Third one is capital, or sometimes it's listed as collateral, or sometimes it's separate. So what's the equity cushion underneath the security behind the loan for the lender? And then what are the conditions? The conditions in the overall economy, are things doing well, are things doing poorly, things going down the tube, that all affects the risk of the loan as well. Credit scoring is a way that is sometimes used, fairly frequently used by lenders to assess whether or not a loan should be given to a client and also the interest rate on the loan. And so they would look at a mix of things about the client, and this would be sort of a typical weighting that would be used. So credit history would be one. Has the company had good payment records on its payments? Has it been a deadbeat? Have a good credit history overall? And buying credit histories, of course, on companies or individuals is a very easy thing to do. How much is owed against income and net worth? So that's always of interest when you or anyone else goes for a loan. They want to know, what do you own, what do you owe, and what do you make? And so there needs to be a good cushion between them. What's the length of your credit history? Have you been in business for a long time? Do you have a very long history of good payments, or no history, or a very short history? So that would impact it as well. And then, what have you borrowed recently? Are you borrowing a lot of money right now? Which for a company starting up, you'd expect it to, but it could also be a sign that something's not quite right. And then, what types of credit are being used? Are you using credit cards, using installment loans, mortgages, other things? So what's the mix of debt that you have and the obligations that there are? So that would be a typical credit scoring type of analysis that would be done by a lender, and you'd have to, if you were short on something, you'd have to be strong on something else in order to get up to a level where they'd be willing to lend to you. Let's talk about sources of startup funding. So if we've got trying to start a business, we know that we're going to depend on equity primarily, so our own money, money that we can talk friends and relatives into giving to us to invest in the company. Possibly, we'll talk about venture capital next, but possibly outside investors as venture capitalists in the early stages, and possibly bank loans. Problem with banks, if you tell me you're going to go out and get a loan, what you have to tell me is what we just talked about. Do you have something that you're getting loaned against? If you need a car for the business, obviously you can take a loan for a car. If you need a building, you can take a loan for a building, piece of land. If you tell me you're going to take a loan for operating money, that's going to be hard to justify. So you've got to have something to pledge against it. You've got to be able to show me that you can convince a bank that you would indeed be able to borrow that much money in an unsecured loan. If you're borrowing against inventory, borrowing to buy fixtures, something of that sort, that's a little different. But really, at a startup business, in order for you to be able to borrow, you're going to have to, with one exception that we'll talk about on the venture capital side, you're going to have something to borrow against. And that may be personal assets or people co-signing for you, but you're borrowing against something. If you don't have something to borrow against, you might as well forget it. So what do you do? This is a survey not too long ago, and I don't think much has changed, that among small businesses that use credit, that borrow money, where does it come from? And among those small businesses, 46%, basically half, said they use personal credit cards. So all those little cards that you all get in the mail all the time, if you don't rip them all up, then they can be used for that. There's a lot of downside to that. The upside is it's there. And if it's used judiciously, it's an automatic source of funding. It's expensive. Rates on those things are very high. But you can get it. So sometimes for startups, that's where a good amount of that operating capital may come from. In the beginning, business credit cards are almost as much. So using a American Express or some other business card for the purpose of funding the business and for those unsecured, day-to-day purchases that we have to make can be used. A bank line of credit is only about 30%. Car loans, other things like that, mortgage loans, leases, those are smaller amounts. So the vast amount of funding for small businesses on a credit basis is from credit cards.
How much funding do you think you can get for a line of credit for a startup? 50,000, 100,000?
It depends on what you're getting the line of credit against. Again, it's, you can't go to a bank and say, well, you loan me $50,000.
What's typical, though?
What I'm saying is you can't say that. You can't get $5,000. You can't. You have to say, what do we have to pledge against that? You know, if I need $50,000, if I need to go to a bank and borrow $50,000, I can do it. But if I needed to borrow $300,000 for a business, I probably can't. Unless I can go to, I'm talking about me personally, if I can go to the bank and say, I'm going to use your money to buy this stuff, and I can pledge that stuff against this loan. And in addition to that, I'm going to write my name on the bottom of this and pledge all of my personal assets. They might say yes. And if I said, all right, I've got this other rich guy over here and he's going to sign it too, then they'd probably say, okay. But you know, it's going that level. So you can't say, I can walk in and buy, you know, borrow $50,000. You can if you have a great credit history and you've got net worth that's more than $50,000. But that's the only way you're going to do it. Okay, I'm going to show you a couple of little things here, and then we're going to do the venture capital next time. A couple short little examples. This one is, talked about financial leverage. I said I had an example for it. Here's a real simple situation where we've got company with operating profit here. So this is this year, and this is next year. Both of these are next year. So this is next year if it's good, this is next year if it's bad. So this year we had $1 million of operating profit, and we expect some variability around that of maybe 10% one of the inputs up there. So maybe our estimate for next year is, well, you know, it's going to be about the same, but it could be 10% bigger, it could be 10% smaller. If the company doesn't have any interest expense, then this would be its taxable income in whatever year we're looking at. And let's say its taxes are 34%, so taxes would come out of that. So if we went up in 10% in operating profit next year, our net income to shareholders would go up by 10%. If we go down by 10% in operating profit, our net income to shareholders will go down by 10%. So the amount of change here will match the amount of change here. As soon as we put any interest payment in there, if we have a fixed interest payment of $150,000, so that's a bond interest payment, we're going to pay it no matter what operating profit is. Well, in this year, with $150,000 payment, this would have been our taxable income taxes. This would have been our net income to shareholders. With that $150,000 there, if we go up by 10% in operating profit next year, net income to shareholders will go up by more than 11, almost 12. If it goes down by 10%, it'll go down by almost 12%. So we've taken, just by putting that $150,000 in there, we take a change in operating profit and make it a bigger change. We amplify that change into what's happening to shareholders. So we've taken this variability on the bottom line and made it bigger. In other words, we've increased the risk for shareholders. We've done it by increasing their upside risk as well as their downside risk. So they'll be happy if things go well. They'll be unhappy if they go badly. And it's fairly easy with not drastic amounts of debt payments to get some very large increases. So here we've got a factor of almost 1.5, where for every percent change in operating profit we get a 1.5% in cash flows to shareholders. So that variability amplification from that financial leverage can be pretty significant.
Dr. Howard, in the taxes cell, why do you multiply by 1 minus the tax rate instead of just the
though, I'm sorry. That would be a mistake. I just whipped that up, yeah. It should be times the tax rate, not times one minus the tax rate. So that those numbers are wrong, but the effect is about the same. So we can do it from up here rather than here. And actually, I think it'll be bigger, so. But yeah, there's. That's what happens when your head's all full of stuff and you try to do stuff. So it comes out to be the same, but those are the right numbers. The other thing I wanted to remind you of is this little note here on tax carryforwards. I had a question on this before class. When you're doing your cash budgets and your income statements, remember that you know you're going to lose money probably for the first year or so, more, and you don't pay taxes when you're losing money, and you don't get taxes back when you're using money. So where normally we'd think of on an income statement taking taxable income minus taxes, which is the tax rate times the taxable income, gives you net income. If you do that and taxable income is negative, you get a negative tax. There's no such thing as a negative tax. You know, they're not going to pay you money back when you haven't paid any money in. So there's what's called a tax loss carryforward rule that says as long as you're losing money, you don't pay tax. You don't pay tax on negative income. So you owe no taxes, and you carry that loss forward. You accumulate it until you start making taxable income. And you write that past loss against future income until you've used up all the loss. And only then do you start paying taxes. So in this situation, here we've got the actual taxable income or loss going out here for several years, going out 10 years. So here we had losses in year 1, 2, 3, and 4, and then positive taxable income in years 5, 6, 7, and so on. But we wouldn't start paying taxes until we've used up all the accumulated gain, all the accumulated loss from before. So here, we by the time we've gotten to this positive year, here, we're still at a minus 21,000. We're starting to write off that loss against our income, so we're down to 15,000 in year 6. We're down to 5,000 in year 7. And in year 8, finally, we use up that 5,000 against the 12,000 of income and have 7,000 uncovered to pay tax on. So that would be the first year we'd pay tax. And then the years after that, we'd have used it all up, so we'd pay tax on the full income. So you accumulate forward the losses that you have, and you don't pay taxes during that time, and you use up all of that write-off until you start paying taxes. And then when you're actually paying taxes, you don't have to worry about this directly, but you know, what really happens is you estimate for the full year what your tax liability will be, and you make quarterly payments against it during the year. So you pay every quarter, you pay one quarter of what you expect the annual obligation to be in the voucher system. So that, for most of you, is going to simplify a lot of what's going on, and the taxes can be an easy place to get things off. The other thing to point out is that it is very unlikely that your balance sheet will balance. It should come fairly close, but there are things that are throwing it off. The main things that will throw it off are this and how you deal with cost of goods sold on the income statement versus how you dealt with the cost of inventory and purchase in the cash budget. And so it's unlikely that when you put everything together right, that the balance sheet is going to balance between assets and liabilities. It should come reasonably close. But what if it comes reasonably close? And reasonably close is, you know, you're not out more than 5% or so, you know, between assets and liabilities. And if that's the case, then it's okay just to go ahead and balance it with retained earnings. Just make retained earnings be whatever it needs to be to balance. Retained earnings normally would be retained earnings from on the balance sheet would normally be from the retained earnings from a previous period plus or minus retained earnings from the income statement that period. But if it's unlikely that, very unlikely, that it will exactly balance. And so typically we'd use the retained earnings account to make it balance, force it to balance on the balance sheet, but it shouldn't be too big of a force. Okay. Any other questions? All right, again, next time we'll be talking about venture capital and then a little bit on risk and return. And depending on what time allows, I'll give you a brief introduction to valuation, which will not be heavily tested. So put your effort into the project at this time. Time to look at what's turned out.
Okay. We should have a cash budget. We actually did, for this assignment, the group did one, and then I was a finance major, and I did one just to see, I don't know, one that wasn't making sense. We tried to do it a different way, and I was hoping maybe you could look over both and see which direction.
Send me the other one, too, then.
And, I sent both to you. Made a note.
Okay. Okay. So maybe
sometime on
Monday?
Yeah, that would be perfect.
Email me.
Okay. I'll email you later.
Doctor, I just had a question in regards to the business plan itself. And more particularly about the construction budget and loan notes that needs to be carried through. Got an idea of how I'm going to go about proceeding. Is that something that needs to be covered in the final business plan and the presentation?
It needs to be in the business plan.
I think what I'm asking is, do I need to do a month-by-month construction cost breakdown, or can I just do a overall construction budget ending at year zero when we start in year one?
So you have basically a construction phase where you're not doing any business.
Right.
Yeah, you can break it up. You need to talk about how you're covering your construction phase and make sure it's feasible. But then it'd be okay to just say, okay, we got the thing built. Here's where we start.
Just jump into it. The only concern is when I turn in the hard copy of the plan, I'll make sure there's enough justification of the construction cost. Yeah. So it doesn't seem like I just said, okay, I got $5 million right here, and I just built a hotel in a day.
Right.
So a little bit of description there will be okay. We wouldn't necessarily have to cover it in the budget presentation.
Yep.
Thank you. Thank you.